strong, which is strong local unions identified with an image, with a number, with a name, with a with good local leaders, is being squeezed and starved and neglected and in favor of maintaining strong centralized control in Washington and in the state capitals. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's, for a while, it seemed to be an effort to make us look like the NEA, so that if we merged, we'd have, you know, comparable structures. But now that, you know, merger seems to be on the back burner, I just think that it's so much a maintenance of status quo in the light of the fact that the local unions are hurting. They're dealing with issues that, that the national doesn't have a clue how to help them with, such as the layoffs. Mm-hmm. It's and they're having to cut budgets because they're losing so many members. It took them forever to figure out that we ought to pay some attention to charter schools and that they aren't good.
Yeah.
They're killing us. Would they listen to the fact that they're killing us? Absolutely not. Somebody had the idea that Al loved charter schools and therefore we ought to be in favor of charter schools. Well, excuse me, it's killing us. And it's now being demonstrated in city after city after city. It is killing us. And the same with NCLB.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely refusal to accept the fact that NCLB is killing us and is purposefully undermining and doing in public education, particularly in the urbans. And that was its purpose. And that's what's happening to us. And instead, we were told in an executive council meeting when we said the NCLB is killing urban education, that, and we have the evidence to show it, we were told that by the president at that time that we shouldn't listen to the superintendents, to our superintendents, which absolutely blew me away. And it's just been this total lack of having the legislative department and the lobbyists challenge the Congress on any of this.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, because Ted Kennedy was in favor of NCLB, everything was fine. Well, it wasn't. And there was hardly anybody in that AFT office who was willing to speak up. And the people that did aren't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that did knew what they were talking about, but nobody would listen to them. So we kept saying, meeting after meeting after meeting, you know, NCLB is killing us. And the charter schools are killing us. And what are we, you know, as an organization, what are we going to do about this? Nothing.
And is,
I mean, it was
too
just
too little, too late now.
Yeah, I think I'm afraid so.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm generally pretty much of an optimist, but in this town, I don't know how we're going to recover.
Yeah,
I just don't know.
And now I see a Spellings report on higher ed side. She came out with a report. And everybody's calling it the NCLB for higher ed. It could be the killing of public universities.
Oh, absolutely. And where it started was with NCATE. I'm one of the AFT rep on the NCATE board. And they're trying to do away with NCATE.
Mm-hmm.
So that higher ed wouldn't have to be have standards and wouldn't have to be accredited. And that's why they started TEAC, which is the competition for NCATE. It's very clearly they're going after higher ed now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's that old saying about first they came for
yeah
whoever, and but it wasn't me.
Yeah.
So it's very clear, and we've still organizationally put our head in the sand. And then what happens? Now there's that coalition of everybody in the education cartel, everybody and their half sister is going after this is the way NCLB ought to change. These are the five principles, and we ought to, oppose it. So who's the last one on? And it looks like an afterthought. So now the AFT joins that coalition. After all this yammering about how we were on the inside, and it would have been worse if we hadn't have been on the inside, and well, there's really good stuff in there, and we can't throw away the good stuff with the rest, and it just needs to be tweaked a little, and if it was just a little tweaking here, fine. But the folks from the Hill who are in that legislative department aren't listening to the folks who are living it.
Mm-hmm. Is it because they've never lived it?
Well, I think it's because they had the legislative agenda, their legislative agenda before they came in.
Right, right.
So I don't know. I rant and rave about it, but I just think that Futures One was unusual in the labor movement. Nobody else was sort of examining itself like that. Mm-hmm. And, having Ray and some of the other folks help with Futures One was a really big deal, and it was a good lesson for other unions to, pay some attention to the future. But after Futures One, obviously there's been a lot of other unions that have sort of have leapfrogged over in thinking about how to totally restructure themselves. And
right.
Some of them are the Change to Win folk.
Uh-huh.
Although they seem to be having trouble now getting along with each other, but
well, we kind of saw that coming.
Yeah, right. But
the steelworkers who are still with AFL-CIO have reinvented themselves into an amazing organizing union. They can organize a plant in a second with their fast organizing plant,
and their education. They have a great education role. And they do a lot of, obviously they've spread out into any worker that walks.
Sure, sure.
And we're still kind of stuck. And I just think it's sort of philosophically or theoretically, I don't know which, not credible to consistently be really good at telling other people how to organize themselves and how to live their professional lives and how to do things, and then not model one iota of it.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's not credible.
Mm-hmm. And you think part of the future is because of the merger? Do you want to get into the merger now? Your blood's boiling already, so.
Yeah, I guess I've gotten myself worked up into it, right?
I mean, part of it was, part of Futures probably is to align themselves more with NEA.
Right.
To make a possible merger work.
Which, again, I don't know whether it was Al sort of didn't articulate it deeply enough or broadly enough or what his vision was enough for people to really sort of understand where he thought he was going with it.
Well, as we were talking about yesterday, there was been two, three theories of what the merger meant.
Right, and I don't know either, but I think it's whatever that theory was that he was operating on in his own mind has passed us by.
Mm-hmm.
And the NEA is going to, affiliate with and is affiliated with the labor movement, either state by state or local by local or state of Washington or Seattle just did.
Yeah.
And what I didn't, well, let me back up a little bit in the history about the Minnesota merger.
Okay.
While we were still in the Minnesota Federation of Teachers, I was a Minnesota Federation of Teachers vice president forever. And it was a, it was a nimble organization. It was a focused organization. It was lean. Had the most respected lobbyists at the state because we were affiliated with the American Federation of Teachers. We had enormous credibility and respect. And when we went to the legislature, people would listen. People liked the legislators liked the AFT, liked Al, and therefore we generally had a leg up, in spite of the fact that we were, a half or a third of the size of the other organization. There was an opening for somebody to run for president of the MFT. I can't exactly remember what year that was, but it must have been early 80s. And some of us who were leaders in the MFT, maybe about a half a dozen of us, got in a room and we'd sort of asked ourselves out loud who was gonna run for the next president of the MFT. And was it going to be me or was it going to be Sandy Peterson?
Mm-hmm.
So we decided in that meeting that I wanted to stay local president. I like being local president because that's, where a lot more action is. And that it was Sandy's turn and Sandy ought to be president of the MFT. So, long story short, she became president of the state MFT. And she was good president of the state MFT. And that... For about 12 years, we had, as officers of the MFT, we had on-again, off-again, cool, warm, whatever, discussions with the Minnesota Education Association about the issue of merger. And it waxed and waned, and it was energetic sometimes with some presidents and not with others.
Sure.
So we kind of got used to being in these merger talks that usually didn't go anywhere. So, however, Sandy was really kind of sold on the issue and really bought the philosophical point that comes with, that she felt would come with it, which would be a future-oriented, whole new look at the organization, at the organizational structure, at the potential outcomes, the potential results if we were one.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of bought that because I always like thinking about the future. When I was in the classroom, I taught futures. I was enamored of that possibility also. When we eventually she and the then I don't know maybe two or three presidents of the MEA finally they got pretty serious about it. And there was a team of the officers of the MFT, the officers, some of the officers of the MEA, and I was there as an AFT vice president and the NEA vice presidents, and this team, and there were staff people from the AFT, a staff person from the AFT, and a staff person, a local staff person who was an NEA person.
Mm-hmm.
And worked for a long time, I don't know, maybe 3 years or so. Now, I will be the first to admit that I got tired of those meetings and eventually quit going. That was one of my mistakes. One of my other mistakes was that I trusted the people who were there in the room to have the best interests of everybody at heart, and they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, the overriding goal of the AFT was just to get the merger, period. They were being so pressured in to get this merger.
So it didn't matter if they wanted to follow a model, whatever model was out there they wanted. They didn't care if the
there wasn't a model out there.
So they didn't follow a NICET model or
no.
Oh.
So what happened is started from whole cloth, started and you know, and to some extent, you know, we couldn't foresee how it was going to work out, but people's, you know, had this good faith belief system that, you know, good intention people could make it work out. And some of the structures, and what we didn't find out until it was too late is that the context, the unwritten, the behaviors and the belief systems and the structural stuff and the are so ingrained that the larger organization just basically became the way the organization behaved.
Hmm.
I mean, it just, as much as people tried to not have that happen, it just became an MEA, a larger MEA. And it became that because, you know, they'd bring in pollsters from the NEA, who were NEA pollsters. They'd bring in facilitators who were NEA facilitators. They'd bring in, you know, PR people who were NEA people.
Or was AFT people?
Well, they'd try to, in the first place, nobody called them and asked them for stuff like that. But in the second place, the AFT couldn't compete financially, and so as a result, those of us who were strong AFT locals and who were big in the old state organizations suddenly were little fish in a big pond with no power. And I kept saying to the AFT that the AFT is disappearing in this state.
Mm-hmm.
It is disappearing before our very eyes. And don't you care? But they really didn't, because they were so enamored of this state merger.
Right.
So I think that when they did the Florida and the Montana merger was next. And that was easier because the teachers aren't a very big part of the Montana Federation. They're mostly public employees.
Yeah.
And then they got to Florida, and they've had a lot of the same kind of struggles in Florida, big time.
Mm-hmm.
And but to this day, nobody really cares in the AFT. I have had endless meetings with the AFT folks that have rather high up, who have been sent out to try to fix or try to mediate or try to develop a memorandum of agreement or try to, you know, to do something about our problems out here. And substantially nothing happens.
Hmm.
A lot of words, a lot of time, a lot of
promises.
A lot of promises, nothing happens. And structurally, it is never going to happen to us now, for us now. So we operate our local union on 29 cents on the dollar. And the teachers are angry about that, because of their over $700, Only 29% of that is kept here to run this local office and to mm-hmm. purchase local staff and to provide the services that they need. They need the services in their school building. They need people to mediate adult conflicts in school buildings. They need staff people to go out and work with them when they've been kicked by a student, and they need people who are on committees to pay attention to their to what the math adoption is going to be, to pay attention to the design of the parent report card. They need to pay, and it takes bodies, and it takes money, and it takes money to keep the building open, to staff it, to do all that kind of stuff. And we're supposed to do that all on 29 cents in the dollar.
Huh.
And it isn't possible. And that it's just, oh, well. So I'm very jaded and discouraged because of that. And as I said at the beginning, I'll accept my... In retrospect, I should have opposed it. I think, we could, had we organized a little bit, we could have opposed it.
Yeah.
And we would have been better off.
Did you take any some of the locals to the merged conventions to raise this up, raise these issues? Or would it have been a folly? I mean, too little, too late.
Oh, to AFT conventions?
Not to AFT, but to... And,
Admin. Yeah, it was too little, too late.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't think they learned enough from it, other than we certainly don't hear anything about national merger anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether that was a part of the learning or not, but it's unfortunately too late for us unless we break away and start a new union.
Mm-hmm.
Or go with Change to Win, or
yeah, that makes some headlines again.
Yeah, right.
Is the same thing happening in New Mexico?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I got to talk to Ellen more about that, but I don't know.
Okay.
As size does make a difference,
mm-hmm.
and when you're absorbed, it's very difficult. And the other part that hasn't worked is that one of the big arguments was, well, think of it, if we're all together over at the legislature and we're the biggest and most powerful lobby. Well, guess what? That we the headlines always say the same thing. The teachers, the big labor teachers union is the one that now contributes more by a lot than any other organization in the state of Minnesota, over $1 million every time.
Mm-hmm.
So what have we gotten for that? Absolutely zero. Absolutely zero. It's amazing how little we've gotten.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing we got was our Minneapolis pension was saved. It didn't cost anything. So it's a big disappointment. Big boo-boo, big disappointment.
Big boo-boo, yeah. I mean, at least in New York, they can say they've gotten things.
Well, and they basically are the organization.
Yeah.
NYSET always was, because they had the numbers in New York City and elsewhere, they always were the dominant organization. So they never can figure out why it doesn't work when you're not the dominant organization.
Yeah, they don't.
All they have to do is ask Buffalo, but, they choose not to ask Buffalo anything.
No, they don't. Buffalo decided to answer last, too, anyway.
Yeah.
But speaking of, we like to talk about futures, why don't we do kind of a wrap-up thing? And usually my wrap-up is the future. What do you see the future for three things? MFT, AFT and the labor movement as a whole.
Well, the future for MFT Local 59, of course, is inextricably tied to the future of the Minneapolis Public Schools, and right now that's very shaky. Minneapolis Public Schools is continuing to lose students. Originally, the demographers said that Minneapolis schools would bottom out in 2008, 2009 and start turning around again. Now they're saying it's 2010, 2011, and maybe it'll turn around. So I think Minneapolis Public Schools may end up being kind of a boutique school district that's really educating part of the city very well and educating hardly anybody in the other part of the city. If we continue, hopefully we continue to educate at least part of the city very well so that we can continue to hold on to that that market share. I think it'll be very difficult for the union to adjust to the demands of the consumer parents as they're exhibiting them now, themselves now, and the issues now. It's going to be very difficult because at least the current leaders don't have the kind of confidence of membership or community that that would require a really dramatic change in how teachers are transferred, assigned, laid off, rehired. Those are issues that require, you know, some finesse, some intelligence, some cleverness in trying to figure out how to deal with those issues. I think the what should have happened a long time ago, which the legislature never did, and it's too late now, I think, is to go to a countywide school system. And had we gone to a countywide school system, so we had a larger area in which to desegregate and to, you know, the three school districts in the country that have, the only three that have successfully desegregated are Louisville and Charlotte-Mecklenburg, and I've kind of forgotten the other two, but it's because they have this huge area in which they can, you know, move people around. We don't. We're, you know, landlocked in this 25 miles. But if we're going to, I hope statewide, we could become a countywide school system, because I don't think it's sustainable to have to continue to have 350 school districts in this with in this small state with as few kids as there are in these little school districts. Plus, then you have principals in every school building. You have a superintendent sitting in a usually in the one school in the district or the two schools in the district. The superintendent's in the office right next to the principal, which is ridiculous. You can't find good superintendents anymore. So we really need in this state to go to a countywide school system. I don't know if the legislature is ever going to have the confidence, the guts to do that. As far as the contract, I hope that there comes a day when the relationships and the quality of the school district leaders and the quality of the school site leaders mean that they actually implement what's in the contract and actually do implement it all. I hope that the state is able to sustain the funding for the professional pay plan and that it becomes so embedded that it it sustains itself and will be continued. I hope that we get to the point eventually where we can count on education leaders to be skilled leaders of professional human beings, and therefore I think in order to do that we need to padlock schools of educational administration and have administrators go to the School of Business and to this and to local academies. I think that in order to continue to attract the best and the brightest, we really have to change what happens with teachers in schools so that they are respected by these skilled leaders, because right now they aren't, mm-hmm. and they feel it, and people are leaving the profession in droves, and young people are not coming in. They're also males and persons of color are not coming in because of the salaries and the working conditions more so than salaries. So as much as people is to complain about the fact that we don't have enough persons of color in the classroom, it's a national problem, and males aren't coming in either. Mm-hmm. And then so the future then needs to be sort of, maybe we could go back to the three new three R's that the AFT brought out a few years ago, and I think I'm the only one that's still using: respect, responsibility, and results. Mm-hmm. And that all relies on building relationships. That teachers and education is going to have to gain some modicum of respect by politicians, by parents, by community people, or it's going to disappear. And the responsibility: teachers are already taking an extraordinary responsibility for student results. They're getting paid partially on student results. They're showing dramatic increase in student results, but they can't do it alone. And the families, the parenting, and the communities have to take responsibility for some of the children and some of their outrageous behaviors.
Yeah.
They just have to, and it's impossible to talk about. You get killed if you try to talk about it. And it's somehow there has to be a turnaround in parents and families and community have to take responsibility for the children. You know, if Bill Cosby can't talk about it, that, you know, white educators can't talk about it. And it has to be. That's one reason why I have some faith in Barack Obama. He at least can talk about it, and talks about it in a very sophisticated way, which is probably why he doesn't get put down for it. But and then results, we're showing good results, but we have to show better results, as everybody says, in order to stay competitive worldwide and to stay help produce graduates that are creative and are intelligent and educated enough so that they know they can work on a team and they can, you know where to go to get information and be creative. Now, by the same token, the labor movement, was there one in between there?
You can do AFT if you want to do labor.
Oh, the AFT.
You already kind of talked about AFT.
Yeah, I just with the AFT, I just am so convinced that it has to tip itself on its head and flip itself around upside down, or it's going to become irrelevant also. And there, I finally convinced Sandy Feldman to have a local leaders task force that I thought was going to be able to get to some of those issues of local unions. At least that's what she said it was going to be about. It never was. Mm-hmm. Never could embrace that discussion. Mm-hmm. And I brought it up at every meeting, as you can imagine.
Yep.
So that was a big disappointment. So I think the AFT is in danger if it continues to be the organization it is, top down. And then the labor movement is scary business. It absolutely frightens me to death. Because what I can't quite figure out is how it gets recreated once it is pretty much down to nothing. And when it was created in the first place, and the labor laws were created in the 30s when all the active organizing, and we talked about the 100,000 people being on the streets, marching on the streets of Minneapolis, and the funeral of the truckers who were murdered by the guards. That kind of energy and that kind of organizing and that kind of recreation of workers' rights, it just doesn't. I can't see the road to that recreation mm-hmm. right now. The only thing that seems to bring anybody out are the folks that are marching today who are illegal immigrant workers who are part of the problem. And they're a part of the problem in that, you know, we continue to bring people here who are willing to work for nothing, and that continues to bring down the... We continue to pull everybody down to the lowest common denominator. We continue to have the good jobs going elsewhere. We continue to have employers who only answer to stockholders, who only think that the massive restructuring means cutting thousands of jobs. And I don't think a country can survive on service work, and it can't survive on without workers who are getting good jobs and getting good pay and benefits, who make up the middle class. So without the middle class, without the labor movement to create the middle class. We have there's a little book that was written and printed by a guy who lives around here. It's called Middle Class Union Made, mm-hmm. and that connection of the middle class union made is absolutely critical. And without the unions, and without the middle class, we are a third world country. And how we pull ourselves out of being a third world country, I think is very questionable. The issue, of course, is how the citizenry understands what's happening to us. And I worry because for the since 1980, the citizenry has been hammered that government is no good. Government services are inept. Taxes are bad. All private sector's good. Mm-hmm. And all of the adults now in this in the decision making and in the voting booth now have been raised on those mantras, and they don't know, you know, to think any other way. The other thing is the countries from whom the immigrants are coming now are countries that are not strong countries, that aren't strong democracies, do not have a strong infrastructure, don't have the kind of good government services that once had immigrants come from. So therefore, they sort of don't have that same understanding of what government ought to do for folks. If the labor movement created public education, and public education and the labor movement are done in the same question, who's going to recreate public education and why? It doesn't have the constituency it once had. And so when my German and Swedish grandparents came here, they came from countries, particularly Sweden, where they paid high taxes, they expected good services, they funded education, through college, they funded health services completely, they funded services in nursing homes for old people. They had those expectations, and those are the expectations they brought here.
Mm-hmm.
But except for us few old Swedes Scandinavians hanging around here, there aren't a lot of other folks that have that kind of experience and come from that kind of a belief system. So instead, even now, the legislature is trying to raise taxes by adding a fourth tier, by restoring the level of taxation for the highest wage earners in this state. Just restoring.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty cut them, and now it's just restoring it. Oh my gosh, everybody out of the woodwork. No taxes, no taxes. Taxes are bad. Can't have taxes. Taxes takes all my money. Aren't taxes awful?
What money are they talking about? They have no money.
Exactly, but that isn't what comes out. What comes out is shouldn't be raising taxes. Even though their property tax is going to go down, it's going to fix their problem, which has been pile everything on the property tax because, the governor wouldn't let any other tax or fee be increased. It's going to fix that for them, but, oh my God, somebody's going to have to pay more taxes. Even if it's somebody earning more than $400,000 a year are the only ones that it's going to touch. And it's not on the first $400,000. It's on the dollars after $400,000.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the folks they're worried about. So I'm not very optimistic at this point. I pray that maybe somebody... And part of the reason I've been really interested in Barack Obama is he seems to be the only candidate so far that can kind of inspire people and really elevate their thought processes and paint a picture of a different kind of country.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any of the rest of them can. But
the only one close, I'd say this, but they're up. But who's the only one who's talking about class issues is Edwards.
That's true, but then he gets hung with the $400 haircut.
Yeah.
And the bird's eye view of his mansion.
Yeah.
And then you think, oh yeah, right.
Completely takes away the whole image.
Yeah.
Baraka continues the message. You look at his where he came from and where he is today.
Yeah. So I know Edwards absolutely says the right stuff, but I don't know.
So is Kucinich, but yeah.
Yeah, right. He's like the little Portuguese guy. So I hope that, the senior citizens still vote at a greater rate than anybody else, and I just hope there's enough memory left there that, mm-hmm. They're going to, that we can help turn it around, but there is so much to turn around. I mean, there are so few CEOs, excuse me, that have the right philosophy that there is something innately and good about and ethical about treating workers well and providing good salary and benefits and working conditions for workers. There's hardly anybody. Who is it? The Costco CEO.
Let's mention him.
And he's terrific. And he takes a small salary, puts it all into the organization. Mm-hmm. He's being really successful, but the Wall Street Journal makes fun of him.
And his best friend's owner of Starbucks only does it to a point. He doesn't respect the workers, but it'll give them just enough to keep them semi-happy. Making coffee. They'll give you a little bit of the stock options. They'll give you a little health care. But once you go over 40 hours a week, though, I doubt it.
Yeah, so instead...
And he's busting the unions in Philadelphia right now.
Ooh. So instead we've got the guys in charge of Circuit City.
Yeah. Who's... Oh, yeah, it's the latest...
Oh, disaster.
Doesn't surprise us because we've been seeing it for the past 5 years, but... It's the latest.
And, who do you lay off and say, get out of here, we don't need you anymore? Your highest salespeople. The people that have gone up your ladder, who have gotten really good at selling your products, and the ones who are selling the most are the ones who are getting laid off, and you're going to go down and get the folks walking in the door. Mm-hmm. And start all over again. And if they want to circle back after a few weeks and try to get their own job back, well, fine, but no benefits, lower salary. And it's for, wasn't it 17,000, or I don't remember how many workers, it was an off 3,400 workers or something. And then we have Wells Fargo.
Yeah,
I mean, the very latest one is Wells Fargo, and they're claiming that they have to lay off all these employees because of the owners of the stock, the shareholders, want a bigger return on their investment. And who is one of the big shareholders? A Saudi sheik. So we got a Saudi sheik who's forcing Wells Fargo into laying off, they're the ones, maybe, is it 17,000 workers, 17,400 workers?
I think it was Wells Fargo.
Right.
Yeah, Circuit was more like 400, 500?
No, I think it was 3,400.
Okay,
so anyway. It's thousands of workers. So you do in all these workers because, some billion, trillionaire Saudi sheik decides he wants more return on his investment. It is, we're being led through a nose ring by the stock market. And how many people are in the stock market? 40% of the citizenry. Uh-huh. Only most of us through our pension or our 401ks. And there's absolutely nobody rarely taking an ethical stand that work in and of itself, and workers are important people. And it's just mind-boggling. It's what I talk about when I go into the pulpit on Labor Day and talk about the ethics and the value of work. And it's just, I don't know. Whether, it's the same way. I think we're at the same point right now with our society and with the middle class as we are with the climate.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to do something dramatic now in order to start reversing global warming. And you can see it in the state of Minnesota now. I mean, very dramatically. Not just our winters, but the vegetation. And everything. And we're at the same place as to whether we're going to save the middle class or not. And we don't have an FDR. We don't have somebody we don't even have an Eisenhower, for heaven's sakes, who said that, people who try to do in the middle class are the ones that are going to end this society as we know it. are enemies to the to our society. We don't have anybody who's willing to take on the robber baron, the new robber barons. Mm. Nobody. It's just, oh, I got to quit ranting. So I don't have a lot of hope for the labor movement right now.
Right now.
Unless we get somebody
We'll see what happens after 08.
Yeah. Unless we get a... Because you sit back... I don't know if you listen to Air America or not.
When the wind is right, I can pick it up.
Yeah.
And try it, yeah.
Well, if you listen to Air America for any length of time, particularly Tom Hartman, you get him in the afternoon?
I think he's on in the afternoon.
Yeah. He is so smart. He is so articulate. He has written about 10 books. They're all good. And listen to him and it's T-H-O-M, Hartman. And listen to Big Eddie Schultz from Fargo, you know, the only gun-toting, meat-eating liberal on the prairie. And you hear the depth of corruption in what has happened to government in this country. The depth of how deep the infiltration of really scurrilous people and bureaucrats has been in this country. It's deep and pervasive. And it is going to take a long time to get, you know, to excise that infestation of snakes and weasels and lice. It's, you know, they're embedded so deeply.
Uh-huh.
And it isn't going to happen between 08 and 09.
But it could be a start.
It could be a start.
But it's going to take a generation.
Oh, man. I hope I live to see it, but I don't know.
I think we covered a lot of ground. I think we did good.
Well, and I think the labor leaders need to get a grip. The labor leaders need to, first of all, get some young, energetic, forward-thinking, and I don't care about, I shouldn't say I don't care about loyalty, but keeping the old fart white guys in power just out of loyalty is not smart anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We have some disastrous examples in our state, and it just weak and no concept of anything. And if we don't get some new labor leaders in both the AFL-CIO and, you know, whatever, Change to Win, whatever, we're not going to be able to help ourselves.
No.
Because they aren't there. I had one other rant.
Okay.
You know, every 4 years or so, or 7 years, or whenever it is, when the labor industry show comes to town, I always do a booth, and I told the director of communications at the AFL-CIO, who's a friend of mine, I said, "Now you watch. First of all, they're going to go to the wrong TV stations, and secondly, the guys who are going to be the spokespersons for the labor industry show, in order to attract people to come down and see the new things that are going on in labor and industry, are going to be old, white-haired, white guys with gold jewelry and a dripping all over."
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, every single one of them, white hair, paunch, you know, the only thing they didn't have was the old cigar.
Yeah.
But gold chains, gold bracelet, big gold ring, and standing there talking about the new labor movement. It was appalling. And I just, every time I saw it on television that week, it just, absolutely drove me nuts. Think, what don't you guys get? Oh, no women, no people of color, no young people.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
They try to shove them into a T-shirt with their tie sticking out.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I love that.
Oh, gee whiz. So, I don't know. Maybe we're doomed. Maybe we're not. I don't know. But everybody, you know, everybody always says, biblically and otherwise, the decay happens from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening to us. Inside out.
You good?
Well, there isn't anything that can happen to this country. There isn't any external enemy that could do to this country what we have done to ourselves.
Right.
Nobody. So, amen and to all that, I guess.
Good place to stop then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.